major questions that non-Christians ask.
It's not going to happen. I have at least an hour and a half's worth of notes here. So what I'm planning to do is just to start at the beginning and stop when we get to 12-ish. And hopefully we'll get through. I've tried to put these in some sort of order so that the ones that we're looking at first are the ones that tend to come up most frequently. So I hope that these things will be helpful. I'd wondered about, would it be helpful to do an interactive time now or a workshop, break into groups and get people to discuss and then feedback. And I do think that that would be a really useful thing to do. We're not going to do it this morning, but I think that would be a useful exercise because, of course, we are all answering these questions, all the time as we talk to outsiders. And so you'll have developed answers and things that you say that have worked really well in certain cases that perhaps would help somebody else who's talking to a similar kind of person. Got to remember what we were thinking about before about tailor-making our answers so that we're not just taking, well, that worked really well for that person, so I'll just say that all the time and parrot off that particular spiel when it comes to this question. But we can obviously help each other with the different insights that the Lord gives us in our dealings with people. So I think it would be helpful to have something like that. But in the end, we thought it would be more useful maybe just to take 5-6 of the key questions that people ask and give some suggestions of things that you might say in response to them. So obviously this is going to be brief and unsatisfactory in one sense, but hopefully there are things here that will be useful. And then the questions that we don't get to, hopefully there's enough on the handout that it'll be clear or reasonably clear what I would have said, and you'll be able to think about those things and maybe incorporate them into answering those questions. So let's just go ahead and jump right in then with the first one, which is probably the most common question that people ask of Christians. If God is so good, why is there so much suffering? And as I was saying earlier, it's so important here especially to be gracious and sensitive and to tailor our answer to this question. This question more than any other question, I think. Some people ask this question and they have never suffered a day in their life. They've never been sick. They've never been bereaved. Their life has just been a bed of roses. There are people like that. And for them, this question is just a weapon that they want to bludgeon Christians with. It's just a clever way to trip us up, to tie us in knots, to make us go round in circles. And you're going to answer that kind of person very, very differently from the way that you will answer parents who are grieving for a child who's just died of cancer. So obviously, here especially, we want to tailor-make our questions. So someone who's just trying to catch Christians out, what do you say to someone who says this? If God's so good, then why is there so much suffering in the world? Well, two or three different responses. How about you don't answer? And actually, this applies to all these questions, to any question that an outsider might ask. There are times when actually the Christian thing to do is to not answer. It's okay not to answer. Very often, Jesus didn't answer. In Mark 11, verses 27 to 33, the Pharisees and the scribes come to him and they ask him what seems like a brilliant opportunity. Brilliant question. By whose authority are you doing these things? Who sent you? Now, you would think that is a brilliant opportunity to talk about his mission and his relationship to the Father and his authority as the Son of God made flesh. What a brilliant question to get asked. And actually, Jesus responds to that by asking them a question, we'll come back to that, by asking them a question, but it's a question that he knows they won't be able to answer, or he knows that they could answer it, but they will choose not to. John's baptism, was it from man or from God? And he asks that question because he knows that they won't answer. And he makes his answer conditional on their answer. He says, if you don't answer my question, I'm not going to answer your question. Which is really just a way of saying, I'm not going to answer your question. So he is effectively refusing to answer this brilliant question about where his authority comes from. Why does he do that? Has he not come to seek and to save the lost? And are these Pharisees and scribes not lost people who need to hear the truth? Well, it's because he knows that they're not interested in the truth. They're just looking for ammunition against him. And sometimes I think that we are too quick to answer people who don't deserve an answer because they just don't care. It's not a real question that they're asking. They don't really want to hear the answer. They're not open-minded. They're not listening to you. Even as you're speaking and you're trying really hard to be gracious and to be clear and concise and to give an answer that's seasoned with salt, but you can actually see in their eyes, they're not listening to a word that you're saying. They're just thinking of the next question that they're going to ask you. And as soon as you answer, it's straight on to the next thing. Well, what about other religions then? They're not really looking for the truth. And Jesus warns us, doesn't he, not to throw pearls to pigs, not to give to dogs what is sacred. And that means that there are people who are pigs and dogs. There are such people, or else Jesus wouldn't warn us about them. We need to be careful that we're not throwing pearls to pigs. So don't answer a fool according to his folly, or he'll be wise in his own eyes. So that's one approach. It's an easy approach in one sense. We just don't answer at all. Another approach, especially with someone, this is a good thing to do all the time, but particularly with someone who's trying to catch you out, is to answer a question with a question. And a book, if I was to recommend one book, one single book on evangelism, then it would be a book called Questioning Evangelism by Randy Newman. Can't remember the publisher just off the top of my head, but if you Google it, it's still widely available. Questioning Evangelism by Randy Newman. And he is basically arguing in that book that a great way to respond to questions that outsiders ask is by asking a question. Jesus usually did this in his interactions with unbelievers. We saw in Mark 11 how he did it to avoid answering a question, but very often he answers questions with questions, not to avoid answering them, but to get people to think. This was his normal way of answering questions. It's not something that he did from time to time in exceptional circumstances. This is normally how he dealt with people's questions. You've got a few examples there on the handout. There are many, many more. And that's a really good way to answer people. Obviously, you will come on then to do more than just ask questions. But very often, people are expecting a sermon. They're expecting a lecture when they ask a question, and it can sort of wrong-foot them in a good sense to throw the question back to them and ask them something. And that works particularly well, I think, with this kind of question if it's someone who's trying to trip you up. An atheist, for example, who's trying to make Christianity look foolish. How can you possibly believe in a God who is sovereign and who is loving when all of this is going on in the world? What a stupid thing to believe. And I think a good way to respond to that is to say, well, okay, what's your explanation? I mean, there is suffering. You're saying there's no God in control of it. So what's your explanation as an atheist? Atheists can try to make Christians look really foolish, but is their explanation so much more helpful and satisfying? What can they say? The best that they can say is, well, everything that happens in the universe is just the random bumping of molecules. Death is just the wastage of evolution. It's meaningless. There's no purpose to it. You just have to accept it. Oh, thank you so much. That's really good. That's really helpful. That's ridiculous, isn't it? Is it not far better to say, well, for all the mystery involved in it, for all the questions that we can't answer, is it not far better to say, here's what we believe, that there is a God who is in control of everything, who is wise and who is good, and he's working all things for the good of those who trust him, and he's going to make everything. Is that not better than the atheist interpretation? So don't answer, or answer with a question, or something that I've said from time to time, and again, you need to know the person that you're speaking to, but I remember using this answer with a fellow that I worked with, again, before I became a minister. That's when I had all these conversations. Why does God allow suffering, you know, if he's so good? And I said, you know, my real problem is not so much why God allows suffering. I don't actually find that hard to understand. If God is so good and we are so bad, and I know myself that I don't love God and I don't worship him the way that I should, and I've spent years of my life ignoring him, and I never listened to him or talked to him or tried to do what he wanted, even though he had created me. If God is so good and I am so bad, my real difficulty isn't so much why he allows suffering. My real difficulty is, why does he allow happiness? Why does he not just blast us all into hell? Because really, that's what we deserve. And yet he doesn't do that. In fact, he gives us so much happiness. So much of us, so many of us have so much happiness in our lives. Most of our time, we're not stretched out on a hospital bed being given intravenous painkillers because we're in agonizing pain. Some people are, but most people, most of their lives, are very, very, very happy. And God blesses them with so much good stuff. And yet nobody ever says, oh, why does a God of justice give so much happiness? That doesn't seem to bother anybody. But then the suffering that's the exception, that really does bother people. And actually that seemed to get through to that particular guy. But you can imagine other people speaking that you'd talk to, and that would just be the totally wrong, totally insensitive, awful thing to say. So you need to know how to answer each one. You need to know the person you're talking to. So that's a way that you might respond to someone who's trying to trip you up. But what about someone who isn't doing that? What about someone who is going through suffering, who's suffering terribly? I suppose, first of all, for someone who's in the midst of trouble and suffering, who is just going through anguish and distress, words and arguments are not really what they need. What they really need most of all from us is compassion and prayer and support and sympathy. They need a shoulder to cry on. They need somebody who will weep with them. They need a hand to hold. Above all, what they need is the comfort and the strength that only God can provide. But for those who are genuinely looking for some kind of an answer, who want us to say something, then perhaps we can suggest three perspectives. And these three perspectives help to set a framework for suffering. It's as if you've got the picture of the suffering inside this framework of these three perspectives. We can't understand the details of the picture. When it comes to the details of the picture, why this suffering? Why so much suffering? Why me? Why now? We need to have the humility to say, I don't know. We may never know. I can't tell you why God has allowed this to happen. But saying that I don't know the reason is not the same thing as saying that there is no reason. I think that's a helpful thing to say when it comes to suffering. I don't know the reason. Nobody knows the reason. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a reason. What we do know is that God is loving, and that God is kind, and that God is sovereign, and that he's righteous, and that he does all things well. And we may not be able to reconcile all of that about God with this or that particular tragedy. But surely it would be arrogant to say that just because I can't reconcile this about God with this tragedy doesn't mean that it can't be reconciled. That would be arrogant, wouldn't it, to say that just because I can't understand it means that it can't be right. We're not going to make our minds the standard by which we judge God's dealings in the universe. It's the tone of voice when we say these things that really is so important, isn't it? It comes back to let your speech be gracious. You could say those things in a way that sounds harsh and cold and unloving, or you could say them with a catch in your voice and tears in your eyes, and it totally transforms the way that it's received. So the attitude, the compassion with which we speak is so important. So we can say something along these lines: I don't know all the answers to your questions, but let me tell you what I do know. Let me say what the Bible does tell us. And the three perspectives that I would suggest that we look at suffering from are the beginning, the end, and the middle. We need to think about our suffering from the perspective of the beginning. God made everything good in the beginning. He put Adam and Eve in a beautiful paradise. It's not a paradise today. Instead, the world is full of suffering. So what went wrong? Well, there was a revolution in paradise. And Adam and Eve chose to rebel against God, who had given them this perfect world. God had warned Adam what to expect if he broke God's law. He was very clear. He said, "You will surely die." And that's why there is suffering and evil and death in our world today. That's why the world is broken. That's why people are broken. It's the deliberate sentence of God the judge upon rebellious human beings. Now, that doesn't explain why some people suffer more than others. Suffering is not evenly divided out. But what is clear is that if God were to give us what we deserve, every single human being would be suffering the everlasting torments of hell at this moment. That's if God were to give us what we deserve. He doesn't give us what we deserve. So that's the perspective of the beginning. The perspective of the end, well, God is not going to allow the devil to corrupt and spoil creation forever. He's said that he's going to restore it to its original perfection. In fact, even better than its original perfection. He's going to give us a new universe. If the only response that we had to people who were suffering from the evil of the world, if the only thing that we could say to them was, stop complaining, you're getting what you deserve. In fact, you're not getting what you deserve a lot worse. If we didn't have anything positive to offer, if we didn't have any hope to offer, that would be a pretty grim message. But we can say, look, the day is coming when God has promised that he will undo all the evil that the fall of the human race brought in. Why does he not fix it now? Why the delay? If God's going to fix it, why is he holding off? Why is he letting more babies die in the meantime? Why does he not abolish all the suffering and punish all the evil? And the answer, of course, is that God delays the end and he tolerates suffering and sin to give people more opportunities to be saved. He delays that day of reckoning to give you, outsider, another opportunity to turn to Christ and be saved. So the perspective of the beginning, the perspective of the end, and the perspective of the center, which is, of course, the cross. And this can be helpful to say to people. In the midst of our suffering here on earth, we need to remember how God himself suffered. And he suffered for our sake. How is he able to give rebels a world that is perfect? How is he able to do those things that we just thought about at the end? It's because he suffered. We suffer in this life. Some people suffer horribly, much, much more than other people. our suffering is not a fraction of what we deserve to suffer. But Jesus, God's Son, suffered all that we deserve. Every last drop. So God knows about suffering. He doesn't know about it in the abstract, in theory, but he knows about it through his own experience. He suffered because of our sin, our rebellion, our stupidity. And that is a hugely important perspective, isn't it? When suffering comes into our lives, you can say to anybody who's suffering, no matter what they're suffering, God understands how this feels. He knows what you're going through. It's not wrong to cry out in anguish to God in the midst of suffering, but the one thing that you can't accuse him of is sitting up in heaven uncaring and unfeeling. The Father knows what it's like to lose a beloved son. Jesus knows about loneliness so bleak that he felt that it was going to crush him as he cried out on the cross, "Why have you forsaken me?" God knows about suffering. God has suffered. Jesus Christ has suffered so that we can have a world that is free from suffering, so that he can put right the problem of our suffering that we caused. So those, I think, are some of the most important things to say when it comes to suffering. Obviously, this doesn't deal with all the questions that arise, but hopefully those are markers that at least... I think an important phrase to use is, I can't answer all your questions, but let me tell you what I do know. And here's what we do know from Scripture. What about other religions? Mental whiplash as we change subject completely. Other religions, you've heard the parable perhaps of the three blind men touching the different parts of an elephant and describing what they think an elephant looks like. They've been blind from birth, they've never seen an elephant. So one of them gets hold of the trunk and he says, well, an elephant is like a snake, it's long and thin. And the other one is touching the side of the elephant, the flanks of the elephant, and he says, well, an elephant must be very like a wall because it's so big and flat and solid. And the other one gets hold of a leg and he puts his arms around it and says, well, an elephant must be like a tree. Of course, I don't know how that works because they've never seen a snake or a tree or a wall before either. But anyway, that's, if you've heard the parable, that's the way it's described. That's how people think of religions. Every religion is like one of the blind men. All the different religions of the world are blind. They have a little bit of the truth, but no one religion has the whole truth. And what we need to do is take all their insights and put them all together. So it's silly to say that this religion is right and these religions are wrong because they are all holding a little bit of the elephant. No one religion can say that it's superior or more true than another. They're all equally valid. I'm sure you've heard this kind of thing. And it sounds really attractive, doesn't it? It sounds so plausible. But actually it's irrational and it's patronizing and it's insulting to all the various religions of the world. Usually it's said to Christians by people who want to defend Islam and Buddhism and all the rest of it. But actually it's insulting to Buddhists, and it's insulting to Muslims, it's insulting to people of all these different faiths. Basically, they're all different paths to the same goal. Well, is that the case? Well, people who say this kind of thing are showing that they really don't know very much at all about the different religions of the world and what they teach. And one of the quickest ways to expose that, the folly of this argument, is to say all religions contradict. They all contradict each other. And they don't just contradict each other in small, secondary, obscure, minor matters. They contradict each other on huge fundamental things. Questions like, does God exist? That's a pretty fundamental question for a religion to ask, isn't it? What is God like, this God that you believe exists? What is he like? What happens to human beings after death? What are human beings? What are we for? What is man's purpose? How do we get to heaven if you believe that there is such a place as heaven after death? So, take any one of those things and just show people how the major religions of the world contradict and that will show them that this is a silly argument. Let's just take one as an example. What do the major religions of the world teach about God's nature? What is God like? Well, Buddhism says that there is no God, for starters. Now, having said that, there are lots of different sects within Buddhism, and there are countless contradictions even between Buddhist sects. And some of those sects do believe in divine beings. The founder of Buddhism, Siddhartha Gautama, was probably an atheist, but actually he has been deified, ironically, by some Buddhists. So that's what the Buddhists believe. There is no God, or, well, maybe there is. Hinduism, it's almost impossible to describe Hinduism because it is just vastly broad. One writer, an expert on Hinduism, said Hindus can be polytheists, monotheists, agnostics, or even atheists. Most Hindus are polytheists, and they have an estimated 33 million gods. So Buddhism says there's no God. Hinduism says there are 33 million gods. What about Islam? Islam says that there is one God, Allah. He's eternal, independent, and omniscient. He's the creator and the sustainer of the universe, but he is so utterly different from his creatures that he can't be known. You can't know Allah. He's called merciful. He's called compassionate in the Quran, but love is hardly ever mentioned. He doesn't enter into the world. He's not interested in a relationship with human beings. He is the source, the Quran says, of both good and evil. He's described in the Quran as the one who guides and the one who leads astray. His attitude to human beings is summed up, I think, by a phrase in the Quran talking about his predestination, I suppose, of the human race. And he says, "These to heaven, and I care not. These to hell, and I care not." So that's the God of Islam. And then you have Christianity. One God in three persons, the Father, Son, and Spirit, the creator and the sustainer of the universe, eternal, infinite, unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. It doesn't take a genius to see that these religions cannot all be basically parts of the same truth. And you could do this exercise with, you could add 15 more religions to it, and you would come up with a broader spectrum of answers. You could take other questions about God and the purpose of man, and you would come up with the same range of contradictions. It's clear that on these fundamental questions that religion is supposed to answer, the religions all contradict each other. They have utterly different ideas. They can't be reconciled. How can God exist and not exist at the same time? How can there be one God and millions of gods at the same time? How can God be unknowable and impersonal and uncaring and at the same time be a God who is love, sacrificing his own son to bring human beings into a personal relationship with him? How can there be reincarnation after death at the same time as eternal life, as one life in this world with the judgment to follow? How can heaven be the obliteration of individual consciousness, as the Buddhists believe, getting rid of all desire, and at the same time be an eternity of sensual luxury and pleasure, as the Muslims believe, and at the same time be the eternal worship of God, as we believe as Christians? So these religions all contradict one another. But then positively, you want to make the other step in speaking to outsiders and say Christianity is unique. It's one thing to show them that all the religions contradict, and that could make them just throw up their hands and say, well, that just shows you shouldn't bother with religion. It's all a waste of time. You want to say, no, wait, stop. There's one that's unique. There's one that is qualitatively different from all the others, and that's Christianity. And the difference between Christianity and all the other religions of the world is the difference between the word do and the word done. all the other religions of the world, for all their variety, are saying that you have to do stuff to get to God. You have to do stuff to be saved. You have to do stuff to get to heaven or to whatever goal they say that that is the goal of man. You have to do stuff. Christianity says there's nothing that you can do to get to God. He has to do it for you. It has all been done by Jesus Christ. Only Christianity has the cure strong enough for our disease. We can't save ourselves. God has to come down and save us. And that's what he's done in his son, Jesus. What about other religions? Okay, homosexuality. Isn't all love good? I heard that just the other day. So this is the kind of thing that is constantly thrown at us, isn't it? Isn't all love good? No, I don't think so. I don't think anybody really honestly believes that all kinds of so-called love are good. There are some kinds of love, so-called, that are harmful, that we would all agree, even the most hardened proponent of homosexuality, they would all agree, if they're honest with themselves, that they are wrong. Incest could be described by someone who practices it as a kind of love. Pedophilia is regarded as a kind of love by those who do it. Narcissism, self-love, the worship of self. An adulterous love for someone who is not your spouse. Aren't these, in a sense, forms of love? And yet, you wouldn't find many people that would want to say that all kinds of love are good. Everybody draws a line somewhere. Everybody will say that some of these things are beyond the pale. So the question is then, well, who decides what kinds of love are good and wholesome and which kinds of love are damaging and harmful? 30 years ago, the vast majority of people would have said, certainly in Northern Ireland, that homosexual love is a bad thing, a damaging thing. Nowadays, the majority of people have changed their minds, or a new generation has grown up, and they say that homosexual love is good. Well, what if in another 10 years people decide that incestuous love and polygamous love is a good thing? If our Creator, God, isn't the one who tells us what is right and what is good, then nobody can tell us what's right and good. Nobody can draw a line anywhere. If we redefine marriage in a different way from how God has set it up, then it doesn't make sense to draw a line anywhere. There is no reason why polygamy shouldn't be made legal. Why should someone who is bisexual have to choose between one or the other kind of partner? If they're attracted to both men and women, why should they have to choose? Why can they not be married to both? If you are in love with many women, why not marry them all? Surely all kinds of love are good. If God doesn't tell us what's right, then no one can. And of course, it's only God who can tell us what we should do with our bodies. He designed our bodies. He knows what's best for us. He's the only one that can tell us how they can be used. And actually, the homosexuality is damaging. It's not a loving lifestyle. There's nothing loving about homosexuality. The word gay was introduced by the homosexual community in the middle of the 20th century as a PR exercise because it gave the idea of a happy, carefree liberation. But the reality, tragically, is that the homosexual lifestyle is anything but gay. The statistics make for grim reading. It's normal for homosexual men in particular to be promiscuous and to suffer from disease and depression. That is the norm for homosexual men. There was a study that was carried out by a homosexual couple, so it's not that they were trying to find this. It's not that they were looking for this result. Quite the opposite. They wanted to show that homosexuality was good and wholesome. A study was conducted by a homosexual couple, which discovered that only 8% of men and 7% of homosexual women ever had relationships that lasted for more than 3 years. Promiscuity among homosexual men is not a stereotype. It's not the majority experience. It's virtually the only experience. Alcohol abuse, drug abuse, depression, suicide, all of these things are much higher in the homosexual community. Doctors who treat homosexual patients are trained to look for at least 15 common afflictions apart from HIV and AIDS. One of the most common things that you hear people say about homosexuality is, surely they're not hurting anyone by their behaviour, so where's the harm? But even just a superficial glance at the statistics show that they are harming themselves and one another. Homosexuality does great damage to those who are involved in it. So all the more reason then for us to be compassionate towards those who struggle with homosexuality or who are trapped in this lifestyle. This comes back to what Paul said in Colossians 4 about being gracious as we deal with these people. Remember what they called Jesus? The friend of sinners. How do you think he got that title? It was because he spent time with outcasts and he talked to them lovingly and graciously. He didn't shout at them in a harsh and judgmental way. He didn't tolerate their sins, not for a moment, but he went out of his way to seek and to save lost people. And I wonder, could people say of us and of our churches that we are the friend of homosexuals? And if there's no danger at all of anybody ever saying that about us, then it makes you wonder, how like Jesus are we? We need to have compassion as we speak to homosexuals, as we speak to people about homosexuals. Homosexuality is a disgusting abomination. That's how it's described in the Bible. It is a sinful perversion of God's perfect plan for human beings. But so is gossip. And so is a man looking lustfully at a woman. And so is losing your temper. And so is gluttony. And so is laziness. There are 6 things, the Bible says, that the Lord hates. 7 that are an abomination to him. Just like homosexuality. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. It's a good perspective to have. Yes, homosexuality is an abomination, and we shouldn't shrink back from saying that. Graciously as it's possible to say that. But let's be quick to point out our own sins and to show where we are committing abominations as well. We're over 12 o'clock. Where's Robert? What do you think? Draw a stop there. Okay. Well, hopefully there's enough there that is at least enough to start you thinking about those other things. If it's just tantalizing and you desperately, desperately want to know what I was going to say about those things, then please feel free to ask me. But hopefully those few things are helpful that we've done. And illustrate some of the principles, at least, that we were thinking about in Colossians chapter 4. Let's pray together.
Our Heavenly Father, we thank you so much